One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Howdy there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I am going to be driving the crazy train today, but not alone. Not alone. That's right. It's me, Cam Hale, and as always, the ticket collector on this wild ride. Sitting across the table from me, he was working on his feng shui in the studio, Mr. Kyle Filson. Philly, how you been, brother?
I am doing excellent, sir. I'm glad you asked. I've been out of town all weekend. me and the wife went and celebrated our anniversary. 8 years now we've been married.
Poor woman.
And we did a lot of window shopping and stuff. Stuff we don't get to do when we have the broods with us. Yeah. I mean, like, we went in some specialty shops, you know, where there's lots of expensive items, glass and things. You can't go in there with those kids. That stuff destroyed. We went to the Apple store. Yeah. Again, another place you cannot go with kids.
Yeah, exactly.
And
you could, but just not the brood.
Yeah, not, my kids are very rambunctious. Like a bull in a china shop. Yeah. Much like me. Yeah. My wife is constantly yelling at me about slamming doors and stuff, and I'm like, am I really that loud?
Bumping into stuff.
Everybody's like, yeah, you are. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. I probably am.
You're a little worked up.
But it was fun. Okay. It was fun to just, we didn't really do much. We went out to dinner a couple times and, you know, window shopping and stuff. It was a lot of fun.
That's good.
I went to a couple of health food shops and found some really neat vitamins and ointments and stuff. Pretty cool. I looked into some of that CBD oil you were talking about. Pretty cool. I didn't buy any because... The issues I have with my knee, I don't think any ointment's going to fix, more like a scalpel.
Yeah, they're going to cut it off, put a wheel on the bottom.
But, I mean, it was really cool, and I like those shops. I like looking at those things. I went to a knife shop. I was looking at buying some new a cooking knife.
Yeah.
I have one I've had for years, made in Germany, and I'm just getting to the point where I want something different, so I was looking at some of those.
You want the meteor knife?
Yeah, I didn't purchase one yet, but I have my eye on an interesting Japanese chef knife. So I'll probably be proud owner of that in the next upcoming months. Also, I saw a really kick-ass blender that I really want. And
you tell how old we are, folks. We're all excited about knives and blenders. And
yeah, right?
I want like a Vitamix.
Yeah,
I want one.
That's the one. That one or the Blendtec. Yeah, I have my eye on. Pretty cool. But that's what I did, man. What about you?
We babysit my great niece.
That's right. How did that go?
It went wonderful. She's so much fun. She's about a year and a half old. She ran around. We had a blast with her. Got her gathered up on Saturday morning, and we had her all weekend pretty much. So we had a great time with that. And it's just fun to actually have little bitty ones in the house again.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know,
I can imagine. I mean, like, that's even when we were away, we were only gone for 2 days. About last night, you know, before we come home, I'm already be like, you know what? It's nice being quiet, but I'm actually kind of missing the noise.
Yeah, well, my daughter was out of town because my son and all of my nieces and nephews all went to the lake up in Lake Texoma and stayed up there all weekend. So they were gone from Friday until they didn't get home till late Sunday. So it was fun to actually have that in the house. It was nice.
Well, that is cool. Well, let's get into today's stories, man. Let's get into the news.
What you got for me, homie?
This comes from Motherboard over on Vice, and it's pretty cool. It's about the Solar Impulse 2, which is a record-breaking aircraft that achieved the first ever transatlantic flight powered solely by the sun.
Cam. Ooh, now that sounds pretty interesting.
With a wingspan of a Boeing 747 jumbo jet and weighing a mere 2,300 kilograms, the plane itself is a technological marvel. Now, while it's certainly not the first solar plane, it is the first in the world to fly for five consecutive days and nights without any traditional fuels. Now, in order to achieve this, over 80 engineers and technicians sought every possible optimization and employed completely novel technologies to provide efficiencies by reducing weight and energy consumption in order to achieve what many aircraft experts consider implausible, if not impossible, a plane with nearly unlimited stamina. Mm-hmm. Now, the article brings up that while the plane demonstrates nearly unlimited endurance, the same can't be said of its human pilots. An unpressurized and unheated cockpit that lacks the creature comforts of a traditional aircraft posed enormous difficulties for the two pilots, Bertrand Piccard and André Borschberg. They said lack of movement, oxygen, and sleep were as taxing on the pilots as the creation of the technological innovations needed for this aircraft by the engineers. In order to keep the plane as light as possible, many of the traditional comforts of aircraft cockpits, you know, had to be eliminated. So on the Solar Impulse 2, long periods of sleep are not possible. They said instead, it's the pilots that were limited to short naps of roughly 20 minutes. Mm. It says Piccard utilized self-hypnosis to rest his mind and body. And he learned this from his background as a psychiatrist and tested during his balloon expeditions that he did long before this. Now, Borschberg, who's a longtime practitioner of yoga and meditation, he says he's honed his discipline of body and mind by focusing his breathing and able to bring relaxation. And because he's used to doing this for long periods of time of inactivity, this is how he was able to achieve these little breaks, these little short naps he was doing. They also used some Jacquard bands for exercise. They said in these very cramped quarters, these are like giant rubber bands. Mm-hmm. They were using this to keep the muscles active, the blood going, because if you sit real still for a long period of time, you start getting numb. Mm-hmm. Circulation goes away. So they had to do this. They said also the pilots' diets had to be carefully regulated. They said expertly designed by a nutritionist, all edible needs were met with the use of fresh products with innovative packaging methods designed to withstand changes in atmospheric pressure and temperatures. So you couldn't just go flying up real high with a bag of Doritos. It would pop, right? Everybody's been, you know, you've been like drive up to Colorado or something. When you get up there, and some of them are broke. You're like, what happened? Yeah. Elevation. But they were able to do it. And they said the temperatures were cold, around negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit is how cold it got down to, up to 140 degrees. I mean, ooh. I'm sorry, 104 degrees Fahrenheit during the daytime. But they did it. Man. Five continuous days and nights. And the plane, like I said, the pilots were the ones that couldn't keep going.
Yeah. Well, I'm more impressed that there's actually a Captain Piccard.
Right? That's pretty cool,
yeah,
right?
Star Trek Generations guy or whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. That's next, his real name.
Yeah, the Star Trek Next Generation or whatever it is. Yeah, that's what it makes. What I'm wondering then, though, is, okay, they talk about the pilots, but what if it's unmanned? How awesome would it be if you could get it unmanned and then use it for mail delivery?
Well, I was thinking, too, is like maybe they can add some kind of like autopilot where the pilot could literally go to sleep.
Yeah.
And the plant, you know,
but
take
the problem still is the it's draining energy if you put a heater or an air conditioner. Or
that's
anything
the problem.
Like that. So if you could make it completely autonomous and have it deliver mail, well, now you got one. But now then you're also dabbling in military, because now you're talking about these guys are going to have one that it doesn't cost a thing. You fly it around the air and it just keeps flying. You know what I mean? Indefinitely wreaking havoc on whatever target you want it to wreak havoc on.
Well, you're 100% right. So, I mean, this is just the beginning. It's pretty cool, though.
Well, I've got something that's almost as cool as that, if not more so. I think you're going to dig this. This actually is a Case Western Reserve University. They had a press release. This comes from eurekaalert.org. And this was something that caught my eye because I'm like, man, it goes into what we've been talking about is when we brought up the jellyfish, where they put like some jellyfish or some stingray and some fake boob stuff, some silicone gel, you know, and they made this thing.
That's right, yeah.
Here's the next step. Researchers build a crawling robot from sea slug parts and a 3D printed body.
Oh, man, they are making advances weekly.
Yes, now get a load of this. It says the researchers at Case Western Reserve University combine tissue from a sea slug with flexible 3D printed components to build bio-hybrid robots that crawl like sea turtles on the beach. That the muscle from the slug's mouth provides the movement, which is currently controlled by an external electrical field. So they go into this. Says the researchers also manipulated collagen from the slug's skin to build an organic scaffold to be tested in newer versions of this robot. So stuff that's upcoming.
Oh, man.
Now, Victoria Webster is a PhD student who's leading the research, and she says that we are building a living machine, a biohybrid robot that's not completely organic yet, is what she goes on to say. Yeah, that's what she's talking about. So they're even talking about, you know, it could leave these, the problems that they have with current robots that you could have like this is, of course, dead batteries. Well, now they're talking something biohybrid. You could imagine it'd be like us being a part robot. You get to eat. Because, you know, you're bio, but now you've got all the robotic stuff going along with it. I can't wait to see where this stuff goes. And there's a lot of people that's been involved in this. A lot of PhDs, a lot of different doctors, professors of engineering, all this stuff that's been getting involved in all this thing. But Webster goes on to say that we want the robots to be compliant and to interact with the environment. That one of the problems with traditional robotics, especially on the small scale, is that actuators, the units that provide movement, tend to be rigid. Well, you think about that. You ever seen those little, they try to make little ants or little spiders, but they've got these big boxes on them, you know,
right?
Where they're like trying to move around and things like that. Well, that's one of the problems. So it looks like they're going to try to find a way, or they have found a way, to work completely around all this stuff. Another one of the researchers, Akuas, actually goes on to say that we've integrated the muscle with its natural biological structure, and it's hundreds to 1,000 times better than what it is when you're trying to use all these things. So look,
this is coming.
Yeah, it's coming. They've already got this. And we've already talked about how they're using a scaffolding that they put in the knee and then they inject the stem cell to try to rebuild meniscus. It's rebuilding things.
Yes.
This is something. Here's what I'm trying to be optimistic. This is the things that I think about. What they're doing here is, let's say that they could grow, you lose a leg in a car wreck, but they can grow you one back. And it's better. It's a bioengineered leg.
Right.
Or let's not even go that far. Let's say people with diabetes, that you lose a leg, but they can bioengineer one that the diabetes does not affect. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways it can go. But this is happening. This is the first steps now. So it's going on.
That is incredible and frightening at the same time.
Right.
Check this out. This comes from Ancient Code. And it's about how researchers recently recovered a lost ancient language that hasn't been spoken in 8,000 years, Cam.
Uh-oh, is it the devil's language? Maybe we don't need to speak it.
It's pretty cool, though. Researchers have posted a fascinating study where you can actually hear how ancestors spoke 8,000 years ago, and I'll put links to it in the show notes. Scientists from the universities of Cambridge and Oxford have managed to reproduce some of the words that originated from a language which disappeared from the face of the earth thousands of years ago. The Proto-Indo-European language is believed to have been a mother language that would give birth to hundreds of other languages on planet Earth, including Roman, Germanic, Baltic, Slavic, and Indo-Iranian. The mother language was spoken sometime between 6,000 and 3,500 BC by ancient people inhabiting the region of the Caspian Sea and the territories of what now are Russia, the Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. Since there is no written evidence, they say that researchers have had to work for centuries to rebuild the original mother language that gave rise to a number of different languages. Now, according to an article posted on the website of the University of Cambridge, it says, no matter whether you speak English or Urdu, Walloon or Waziri, Portuguese or Persian, the roots of your language are all still the same. Proto-Indo-European is the mother tongue, and it was shared by several hundred contemporary languages, as well as many now extinct, and spoken by people who lived from about 6,000 to 3,500 BC on the steppe in an area north of the Caspian Sea. So far, no one was able to figure out what this language sounded like. However, scientists from the British universities of Oxford and Cambridge have applied a methodology of acoustic phonetic statistical processing. Say that again.
For sure.
Called statistical forms, which allowed them to recover lost sounds of words and how they sounded 8,000 years ago. And this is how these scientists were able to reproduce the origin of some of these words we still use today, as the number one in English that comes from the word onos from the PIE language. They were able to reconstruct some words used in modern Romance languages, tracing back their origin to Latin. Now, according to these writings on the website of the University of Cambridge, the longest path of development simulated so far goes back 8,000 years ago from English 1 to its PIE ancestors, and likewise for other numerals. So basically, they finally have figured out how to reproduce the sounds that have led to our language. And what they're saying is all these languages that people speak nowadays all has the root in this one language from this one area of Europe. So it's pretty interesting. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. I've got something. When you started talking about that, I started. I'm not riding down the street smoking Indo. I'm driving down the street talking Indo.
Right.
I'm like, yeah. What is? I don't understand, man. I just like to be a linguist. I can't imagine to go to school to go. I'm going to school to be a linguist.
It's got
to
be hard,
especially for like a dead language. But that is pretty fascinating.
The Proto-Indo-European or PIE language.
Jeez, that is so. Yeah, that's too much. Well,
they got a video before you start. They got a video, like I said, I'll put links to it, where it's like 20 minutes long of them pronouncing the way it used to sound.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Well, it is. It's fascinating that we can find that, but then nobody wants to agree that there's, you know, older civilizations on here. I'm like, come on now. Right. Now let's go. But what? Yeah.
Well, I saw recently where they found another Bible. This was one that they found somewhere in Scotland, I believe.
Yeah.
And it talks about a civilization prior to the civilization. Prior to Adam and Eve, basically.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty interesting. Of course, you know, like, super Christians are denying it. But what I think a lot of people don't understand is the King James Version of the Bible that we have nowadays, it was assembled.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many other books and other Bibles that are just not, you know, they're not looked upon for whatever reason. This is another one. This is a new one that they just found. And it's talking about all these stories before Adam and Eve. And it talks about the same things. The Exodus. It talks about the Great Deluge, the Flood. Even Jesus Christ. I mean, it has a whole lot of things. And they thought was written in ancient Egypt, I believe. And really? It talks about a civilization here before Adam and Eve.
Hmm. I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah,
that
I have to. I'm trying to remember what the name of it was. It's like the Colebrook Bible or something like that.
Check that out. That sounds pretty interesting. Yeah. Well, I got you something else pretty interesting. This comes from our buddies over at openminds.tv. Mr. Roger Marsh is at it again, folks. Get out your pens, get out your paper. Case number 77679 from Oregon. Lebanon, Oregon, actually. There's a witness that saw a fast-moving object crossing his property. Get a load of this, guys. Just 4 feet off the ground, and it says that it created a water-like distortion in the air.
That's weird. How do you explain that?
Well, the minute I hear that, I always think of like the heat distortion coming off of a road.
Right.
But you got to imagine that maybe it's a heat trail of some sort, something. It says the event occurred July 10th of this year. It was reported to MUFON on July 14th. This is what the witness stated. Something traversed between my wife and I about 4 feet off the ground that made an unidentifiable noise and the speed of which was extraordinary fast. Neither of us place any credence in aliens among us or visitations. Says it goes on that the witness believes the physics against such things are irrefutable. My career was in astronomy on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. My wife was a banker and an accountant. And he goes on to say that whatever it was created a distortion in the air between us for an instant. We live in a suburban area and our residence is surrounded by a fir forest. To the right of me, from whence it came, is a 150-meter tall hill about 50 meters away, which we also own. Aside from the noise of the event, there was absolutely no report one might ascribe to the discharge of a firearm. Our area is for the most part dead quiet. If it were a bullet or etc., it would have been able to climb a 150-meter tall hill, go over the top of it, and then descend to our level and go absolutely parallel to the ground between us, is what he's asking. So it's not a bullet. It's not like it was shot out of a gun. It went up and over, and it's like it's keeping 4 feet.
And he could see
foot.
This, or he could just tell there was a disturbance. Like, I'm having trouble following
what he's
story,
saying is it was
I mean?
Moving, but it was just a disturbance. Something went between them that was a sound and a disturbance, the way he's telling it. He says, I have been reluctant to report this because of my own core beliefs. However, one of my friends encouraged me to do so anyway. I have a home observatory, and I do a lot of observing and hunting for NEOs. I have yet to see anything unexplainable, either here or on top of Mauna Kea. Having said that, the event my wife and I witnessed not only frightened us, but left us with profound curiosity as to its origin. The distortion in the air between us looked as if we were looking through water. The noise was subtle, but unlike anything we have ever heard. I own guns, and I know a ricochet when I hear one. Am I alone in this, is what he's asking. So basically, the object, it doesn't sound like he actually spotted an object. What he's saying is something, but it looked like it distorted. He heard the sound and a distortion of water, which is all we've always talked about. If you look at a slow-mo firing of a large caliber rifle round, it looks like water, the way the vapor trail or the way it's affecting the atmosphere around it as that bullet travels.
Yeah, people don't realize you can see the bullet. If you're shooting at a long range, you can see it.
Yes. Yeah. So the way it sounds is something along those lines passed, but what he's talking about is it come down off the hill, came down, and it's keeping a constant elevation of 4 feet rippling and like whipping along the top of the ground.
Right.
So, and what he's reporting does sound like a bullet, but it also sounds like it's too big, moving extremely fast. You didn't see it. You didn't hear the report, nothing. And like he said, it come over the hill, come down. It's not like a ricochet. It's none of that. So what is that that's making that crazy after trail coming through there?
I have no idea. Maybe some guy has got a super, you know, revved up drone.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You know, some redneck up there in Hawaii. He's built one, you know, up there. He's got BJ Penn and the rest
of that. This is in Oregon is where he saw it, but he used to work as an astronomer in Hawaii.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought the story was taking place in Hawaii.
No, it's in Oregon. So he's talking about it's like out in a big field that they live in. I'm just trying to think of what anything that you could misidentify it as.
Man,
and there's nothing that comes to mind that you could easily miss it, because you would be able to see something making that distortion.
Yeah.
Unless it's teeny tiny.
Man, that's
the only explanation. It's really, really small. But then even then, I've never seen a bullet make that kind of distortion between 50 feet between two people as it whips past you and continues on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You wouldn't, it just...
That is...
I just haven't seen that. So, I don't know. But it's just, it really caught me funny because I was like, he's not reporting a vehicle. He's reporting something that's distorting what's around him.
Man, that is cool. Well, keeping informed with that UFO story, on today's show, I'm going to be getting into a lesser-known crashed UFO that happened right here in the United States back in 1941 in the great state of Missouri. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
When it comes to UFOs, there are several types of sightings one could possibly have. The term close encounter was coined by the American astronomer and ufologist Joseph Allen Hynek. He used it in his 1972 book, The UFO Experience, A Scientific Inquiry. Hynek proposed three types of close encounters. A close encounter of the first kind is the sighting of one or more UFOs at a distance of 500 feet or less. A close encounter of the second kind is the sighting of a UFO with associated physical effects, like heat or electrical interference. And a close encounter of the third kind is the sighting of an animated being, presumably an alien, but not specifically defined as such. Since Hynek's original classification, several more types have been suggested, although these are not universally recognized, such as a close encounter of the fourth kind. This is when a human abduction by an alien occurs, and may also include voluntary experiences. A close encounter of the fifth kind, which is voluntary bilateral contact between humans and extraterrestrials. Then, a close encounter of the sixth kind, which is the death of a human or animal associated with a UFO sighting. Cattle mutilations would fall into this category. Finally, a close encounter of the seventh kind. This is the creation of a human-alien hybrid, either by sexual reproduction or by artificial scientific methods. There have even been subcategories added to the close encounter of the third kind, such as subcategory A, a being is witnessed inside of a UFO. Category B, a being is witnessed both inside and outside of a UFO. Category C, a being is witnessed in the vicinity of a UFO. Category D, a being is observed without the presence of a UFO, but UFO activity is reported in the area around the same time. Category E, a being is observed without the presence of a UFO, and none have been reported in the area at the time. Category F, no entity or UFOs are witnessed, but the subject experiences some kind of communication. And finally, category G, an alien is injured, captured, and/or killed. Which leads us to today's story. Now, when it comes to the crash and retrieval of an alien aircraft and its occupants, none is more well known than that of the Roswell crash on rancher Mac Brazel's land in the summer of 1947. But there are others, lesser known cases. Some of these we've even talked about on the show before, like the April 17th, 1897 crash in Aurora, Texas, or the crash in Paradise Valley, Arizona, in October of 1947. Or the crash in Aztec, New Mexico, on the 25th of March, 1948. And many, many more. And also from other countries, like Russia, Norway, Brazil, and France. The crash I'm talking about today took place before Roswell, in a little out-of-the-way town known as Cape Girardeau. The incident in question took place in the spring of 1941. Born on the Mississippi River more than 200 years ago, Cape Girardeau, Missouri, has evolved from a tiny trading post to a frontier settlement governed by a French-Canadian commandant, and it took to thriving into a culturally rich community of now more than 38,000 residents on the world's only inland cape. And back in 1941, the population was much smaller. This was a time right before America was thrust into World War II due to the bombing at Pearl Harbor. A man named Reverend William Huffman, who might have been kin to Logan Huffman it's still unclear, had been an evangelist for many years when he moved to Cape Girardeau to take over the minister's reins of the Red Star Baptist Church in early 1941. Church records corroborate his employment there during the period in question. Well, on one springtime evening, we think middle to late April, Reverend Huffman was washing up and getting ready for bed after doing a couple hours of reading and planning of next week's sermon when the house phone began to ring.
Hello?
Hello, Reverend. This is Frank down at the local sheriff's office. We've had an incident. We want to know if you can help us out. There seems to be a few people that could use your assistance. We'd be more than happy to come pick you up. It's all right with you.
It was the local sheriff and one of his deputies. He was calling because there was some sort of accident outside of town, and they needed a priest or reverend to come out and provide spiritual support and perhaps do some blessings or even final rites. Reverend Huffman agreed, and they sent over a squad car to pick him up. It was late, almost midnight, when the car arrived, and it was not a squad car. It was just a black car. The Reverend got inside, not really knowing what to expect, not knowing that he was about to witness what would change his future outlook on life and shake his very spiritual foundation. As the car drove to the site of the accident, the Reverend asked the driver, "What type of accident are we talking about?" The man said, "It's a plane crash, and they needed you to get there quickly." After driving for a while, the car finally made it to the scene of the crash, to some woods, 15 miles outside of town. Upon arriving at the scene of the crash, he saw policemen, fire department personnel, FBI agents, and photographers who were already mulling through some of the wreckage. He introduced himself and asked if there was anyone there who needed any of his guidance. They told him that he was too late. All three members of the party had already expired. They asked him if he would pray over the three dead bodies. Of course, he agreed. As he was preparing to go into prayer, his attention was drawn away from the three bodies, which were covered in sheets at his feet, by something going on to his left. There was a lot of activity, only 20 or 30 yards away. He looked at what was going on, and that's when he saw the craft. Expecting a small plane of some type, he was shocked to see that the craft was actually disc-shaped. He stopped whatever he was doing and approached the craft. He looked at it intently and studied every nook and cranny. He was shocked at how smooth it looked, how shiny it was, and he began training his view towards the inside of the craft, where he saw hieroglyphic-like symbols, indecipherable to him. He knew instantly that this was nothing built by men. He was then shown the three victims, not human as expected, but small alien bodies with large eyes, hardly a mouth or any ears, and completely hairless. Immediately after performing his duties, he was sworn to secrecy by military personnel who had taken charge of the crash area. He witnessed these warnings being given to others at the scene also.
"All right, people, listen and listen good. None of this is real. You're not to talk about this to anyone. Understand? No one needs to know about this or you'll be sorry. Now line up. We're going to have each one of you sign a non-disclosure agreement between yourselves and Uncle Sam. Like I said, none of this ever happened. Got it? Good. Now line up."
As he arrived back at his home at 1530 Main Street, he was still in a state of shock and could not keep his story from his wife, Floy, or his sons. This late-night family discussion would spawn the story that a woman named Charlotte Mann would hear from her grandmother in 1984 as she lay dying of cancer at Charlotte's home while undergoing radiation therapy. Charlotte was told the story over a span of several days, and although Charlotte had heard bits and pieces of the story before, she now demanded the full details. As her grandmother tolerated her last few days on Earth, Charlotte knew it was now or never to find out everything she could before this intriguing story was lost with the death of her grandmother and gone forever. She also learned that one of the members of her grandfather's congregation, thought to be Garland D. Fronbarger, had given him a photograph taken on the night of the crash. This picture was of one of the dead aliens being held up by two men. Charlotte Mann gave in her own words an account of what she knew for a television documentary. Some of that account is as follows. I saw the picture originally from my dad, who had gotten it from my grandfather, who was a Baptist minister in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, in the spring of 41. I saw that picture and asked my grandmother at a later time when she was at my home fatally ill with cancer, so we had a frank discussion. She said that grandfather was called out in the spring of 1941 in the evening around 9 to 9:30 p.m. and that someone had been called out to a plane crash outside of town and would he be willing to go up there and minister to the people there, which he did. Upon arrival, it was a very different situation altogether. It was not a conventional aircraft as we know it. He described it as a saucer that was metallic in color, no seams. It did not look like anything he had seen before. It had been broken open in one portion, and so he could walk right up and see that, looking in, he could see details such as a small metal chair, gauges, and dials, and things he had never seen before. However, what impressed him the most was around the inside there were these inscriptions and writings, which he did not recognize, but were similar to Egyptian hieroglyphs. There were three entities, or non-human people, lying on the ground. Two were just outside the saucer, and a third one, well, that one was a little further out. His understanding was that perhaps the third one was not killed on impact, and perhaps later crawled out. There had been mention of a ball of fire, yet there was no fire around the crash site. But none of these entities had been burned, and so Father did pray over them, giving them their last rites. There were many people there, fire people, photographers, and so they lifted one up, and two men on either side stood him up, and they stretched his arms out. They had him up under the armpits and out here. As I recall from the picture I saw, he was about 4 feet tall, appeared to have no bone structure. He was very soft looking. He had a suit on, or what we assume was a suit. It could have been his skin, and what looked like crinkled, soft aluminum foil. I recall that this thing had very long hands, very long fingers, and I think there were three, but I cannot swear to that. My grandfather, upon arrival, said that there was already several people there on the scene, two that he assumed were local photographers, fire people, and not so long after they arrived, the military showed up. They surrounded the area. They took them off in groups separately and spoke to each one of them individually. Grandfather didn't know what was said to the others, but he was told that this didn't happen. You didn't see this. This is national security. It is to never be talked about again. My grandfather was an honorable man, being a preacher. That's all he needed to be said to him. So he came home, told the story to my dad, who was there, and my grandmother and my uncle. Now, my mother was expecting at the time, so she was off in the bedroom sleeping. My sister was born May 3rd, 1941. So we're assuming this was in the middle or last of April. He never spoke of it again. But about 2 weeks later, one of the men who had a personal camera that he had put in his shirt pocket approached grandfather and said, "I think someone needs a copy of this. I have one, and I'd like you to keep the other." So that's how it came about that grandfather had the picture to begin with, but he never spoke about it. The other people seemed to be very intimidated and very frightened and paranoid about the whole event. Now, there are other living supporting witnesses to this event, including Charlotte Mann's sister, who confirmed her story in a notarized sworn affidavit. And of course, the living brother of the Cape Girardeau County Sheriff in 1941, a man named Clarence Shade. He does remember hearing the account of the crash, yet does not have many details. He does recall hearing of a spaceship with little people. There are also fire department records of the date of the crash. This information does confirm the military swearing department members to secrecy, and also the removal of all evidence from the scene was done by military personnel. At least, they had records until the 1990s. It now appears that several of the documents backing up this story are now missing. A woman named Linda Wallace was born in Sykeston, Missouri, which is next to Cape Girardeau. When Linda was very young, her father worked at the Missouri Institute of Aeronautics in Sykeston and may have been privy to information of a downed UFO between Cape Girardeau and Sykeston 6 years before the alleged crash of course, the iconic flying saucer at Roswell, New Mexico. Now, she claimed that on her father's deathbed, he confessed to the story being completely true. And after her father's passing, she became interested and wanted to try and find any evidence that this fantastic story might actually be true. Sometime in the 90s, Linda discovered that the local fire, sheriff, and police departments now have no records at all for the year 1941. Nor do any records from that year exist at the Missouri Institute of Aeronautics. She said stories had been removed from microfilm issues of the Sykeston Herald around the time of the alleged crash. She said, "I thought that was unusual. I'd gone to other dates, and they did not have any similar problems. I looked for anyone that might have an original newspaper for that week, and I haven't found one yet." But she didn't stop. She didn't get discouraged. Linda did what any researcher does. She started asking questions. One source spoke about little people that died and were transported from the alleged crash site. An unrelated source spoke about a fairly recent visit by a former associate of the Missouri Institute of Aeronautics. And in her words, she said, "There is a man, somewhat confused, who said he'd picked up some of the bodies of the crash victims from the army base. Linda found that man, and he was locked away in a wing of the Sykeston's nursing home. I identified myself," she said, "with my father's name, and the man's face went from a blank look to an ear-to-ear grin. The man went on to tell her, 'Your dad was my crew chief. That was so long ago.'" After a few questions, Linda was satisfied that this man had indeed known her father. "I told the aging patients," he said, "I would like to discuss the Missouri Institute of Aeronautics and the air crashes that were never reported." Unfortunately, she said the blank look had returned back to his face. "I don't know," he said. "I don't know." He was lost again, and we were never able to reconnect. Now, after that man died, she discovered that this was the man who had spoken to her unrelated source about the bodies. These are the interviews that keep Linda's research going. She says, "I get bits and pieces of the stories, evidence to either prove or disprove the event. It only leads to more questions." So I continue. She said that other people in the area talk about the crash of a meteor near the area, and others don't report the incident happening at all. So she said, I continue to search. So, what are we to think of this case? Did a mysterious craft crash in the woods of Missouri, 6 years before the world-famous crash in Roswell, New Mexico? And why is it that the Roswell crash is so big, and not this one, and many other lesser-known crashes? There seems to be many witnesses and documents to back up the fact that something strange was definitely going on at that time in Cape Girardeau. At least those documents existed for a time. Now it seems that they're missing. Maybe there were several loose ends, because this was one of the first few times the government ever had dealing with a crashed UFO. They didn't know how to handle it or how to cover it up. It seems to be that there are numerous cases of crashed flying machines, not of this world, going back to biblical times, like the ancient Indian flying machines known as the Vimanas, all the way up to current times. Perhaps they've just gotten better at disguising them.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. An interesting story, as always, like we always cover on the show. I know every time we get back from a break, I say the same thing. Interesting story.
It's a drinking game.
But they are interesting. And this is a lesser-known crash case. And it is kind of strange that the Roswell crash is the most popular, but there's all these other ones that, to me, are just as intriguing. I wonder why the Roswell one is so much bigger than all these lesser-known ones.
Probably because it got out of hand faster. Before the government could put a lid on it, or maybe there was just more people noticed the government involved in it, something like that.
I think you might be right.
And like I told you, I kept thinking, man, where have I heard this story before? And like we discussed this, I'm pretty sure that's kind of the idea behind one of those episodes of the new release of the X-Files.
It was
kind of like something about
that. It wasn't exactly, but basically the story was very similar. So obviously they were inspired by this story.
They had looked into it, yeah.
Well, and what's also odd is the fact that there were documents supporting that this happened. The local documents there at the fire station talked about the military coming out there and making all the employees swear to secure, to not mention any of this. And then in the 90s, when that Linda lady was looking, all those documents are gone now. Even if you go to the library in that town and you go on the microfiche, all the newspapers from that week, surrounding that week, they're all gone now. They have no records. If you go to the police station in that town, we're talking a small town. They said the population today is 38,000. So back in 1941, though, is more like 5,000.
Yeah. Gone.
The police have no records of anything from the year 1941 in that town. I mean, it's a little weird. It's almost like somebody came back
and cleaned it
all up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what happened.
So nobody can go and look into it.
Yeah.
Because if nothing happened, why would you do that?
Exactly.
You know, if nothing went down there, the problem is this, you could easily go in there and what's easier to do? Is it easier to make a fake story and try to say it was weather balloons or it was dummies and all that stuff? Or was it easier to clean it? Well, it was easier to clean it. just wipe it away. But that does leave a gap. Whereas maybe they learned from that. The government is who we're talking about, these people that do this. Maybe they learned, hey, that throws up more red flags than just making up fake stories and muddying the water. It's easier to just go ahead and poison everybody, you know, and just kind of get everybody talk about different things and release all this disinfo than it is to send guys in there to steal, to, you know, to threaten and to clean everything out of that little town.
Yeah.
About it. It's just easier that way.
Well, you're 100% right. And they even, the Reverend, Mr. Huffman, he talked about being an evangelist for years, his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that night, it really changed his outlook for the rest of his life. He said his spirituality was affected. It said it shook the very foundation upon all his beliefs were based on. Because here we are, a pious and Christian man, and then he sees these extraterrestrials, and he said he knows that that craft was not of this world.
Yeah.
He said it, you know, it changed him. Now, he didn't stop being a reverend, but it definitely changed him. And his kids and stuff said he never talked about it. He never talked about it. The only time he was brought up was on his deathbed. And then the woman that moved from Cape Girardeau to Tyler, Texas, she said her mother was dying of cancer and was living with her. And she knew, you know, hospice was already involved. And she knew she only had a few more days. And she said, I knew right now, if I don't get this story from my grandmother, it's going to be gone forever. So she made her grandmother tell me the story and the details about all that. And, of course, that's what I read during that segment. But, I mean, is that, like we always talk about, deathbed confessions are funny things.
Yes.
Of course, they could be fabricated.
Mine's going to be a funny thing.
Well, yours is definitely, no matter what it is, I'm like, he's definitely trolling, y'all. But would a reverend or somebody else like that, you know? I don't know.
It's hard to, you know, part of you wants to believe that any sort of religious figure is legit. And then part of you thinks, yeah, but they're just human beings. And the same as any of that stuff. But I don't know what it is about old people makes you want to go, yeah, that old person was there and that old person's believable. You're like, yeah, but old people are liars too, you know? I mean,
but the Reverend remembered it, his family, because when it happened, he was told not to tell anybody by the government. But he said when he came home, he doesn't keep anything from his wife. And he told his family about it. Her brother and her sisters all remember about him talking about it. Her grandmother remembers him talking about it. Several people in the town remember it happening.
Yeah.
They've seen the army in there cleaning stuff up, taking stuff away on flatbed pickups.
Why would he just make up a story to go along with the army being in a town?
Right?
Yeah.
Could it all be manufactured? I mean, come on, man.
Something happened.
I believe something absolutely happened that night. And also, in the story, when he's talking about peering into this saucer-like craft, the hieroglyphs, he said it looked like Egyptian hieroglyphs. What do they say? We talked to him before. John Burroughs. We talked to John Burroughs. We met him. He was at Rendlesham. They talk about strange writing on the exterior of that craft. So,
makes you wonder,
are all these things coming from the same, you know, dimension, the same galaxy, the same wherever? Could that be?
Could be, yeah.
What, in fact, was going on? Well, moving on. This is the, Cam, you're going to like this. I saw this article that just came out the other day. This comes from The Guardian. It's about how South Africa's great white sharks face extinction.
Good for them.
Says study. Now, I knew you would like this. They said South Africa's great white sharks face the threat of extinction after a steep decline in the numbers caused by trophy hunting, shark nets, and pollution, according to a recent study. They said a six-year research project along the country's coastline revealed that only between 353 of the 522 tracked sharks are still alive, half the level previously thought. It said the numbers in South Africa right now appear to be extremely low. If the situation stays the same, South Africans, great white sharks, are heading for possible extinction. So my question is to you.
Oh, here we go.
Are you worried about this? Does it bum you out?
Look, I don't want to see anything
that these
extinct.
Giant 1,600-pound monsters with teeth are slowly becoming extinct.
I don't want to see anything go through an extinction. You know, it's here, especially if it's us that's causing it. It's one thing if it was just on their own, they weren't breeding or something. If it's us that causes it, I don't want to see anything like that. But it's hard for me to feel bad for these monsters that are in the water. You know, I'm just, but here's the thing, too, that I've read and look, is it's usually, what's funny with a great white is they say they'll bite you lots of times. They're not biting you to feed.
Right.
They're biting you, oh, they didn't know what you were. It was a reaction bite. The problem is they're so damn big, usually you bleed out. You're
it doesn't
done.
Buff out.
Yeah. Well, lots of times, like a bull shark or a tiger shark I've read, when they bite you, it's because they're hungry. You know, they're biting you to bite you for a reason, not the great white. It's just he's just the biggest. So he's kind of like, I want to hold him and squeeze him and, you know, pet him. And he doesn't mean to kill you. He just, oh, my bad. You know, it's just like, my bad. I didn't mean to run over that old woman. My bad. It's just the way.
I think you're right. I think a lot of times they think that we're seals or sea turtles, yes, or something. And yeah, then by the time they bite in, they're like, oh, that's really bony. That ain't what I like.
That's not what
the
it
problem
was.
Is you have massive holes in your torso, yeah, or your leg is completely removed.
You're not holding fluid anymore.
No, exactly. I don't know, man. I understand, you know, we joke about it all, yeah, the time. I do understand that they have a part,
yes,
in nature, and, you know, they eat all those seals, and so they play a part. But there's also a part of me that's like, man, you know, I'm not.
In the back of my mind, there's a little kid part of me that's like, I wish tigers would all freeze to death. I wish sharks. But really and truly, I just want to get rid of mosquitoes. I mean, that's like we've always talked about. That's the biggest problem.
Well, you're right.
We have to deal with a mosquito. But you know what? I don't want to see anything go like that. My problem is this. I think there needs to be tighter rein on fishing and all that worldwide in the ocean.
Yeah, well,
because,
agree,
you know, there's certain, we have all these rules in freshwater and even
the population
in
is the problem.
But you get out there and people just exploit it. They just rape the oceans. And I'm like, look, can we put a little tighter rein on it? Can we all agree that, look, it's okay if you take one, let's find some alternatives. People start eating more carrots and more celery and cut back on the pollock or the cod or whatever you're dragging out of there. Let's knock that off. You know, hold off a little bit. Instead of going and buying that cheeseburger one day today, just everybody don't buy a cheeseburger one day a week or something. You know what I mean? Just,
yeah, I know,
let's all do our part so we're not treating the oceans this way. Because like I said, look, I hate them because they scare me. I don't have any personal vendetta against them. I don't want to see them die like that. But it is funny that you kind of like, ha, 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 but I don't want to see him go out like that. You know,
man,
I mean,
see, that
on.
Is that's a surprising response. Look, Cameron Hale has a heart. I figured you'd be cheering.
Yeah, and like I told you, the kid brain in me is like, yeah, I hope they all die. But I don't know what the repercussion would be,
right, no,
you know, if they didn't have any shark or anything like that. Folks, I've been putting this off, and Kyle and I have been putting this off for a while, and you're going to have to bear with us, folks. Everybody that's been writing reviews, no matter where you find the show, wherever you hear us from, it doesn't matter where it's at. If there is a place to review it, please go there and review it and give us a rating and a review. If you listen through the website and you can't do it at iTunes, go to Podbay, go to Podbean, go somewhere, write us a review, please. You can leave us a message on the website, any of that, but the reviews, when it files into iTunes, it helps keep us at the top of the list. It, yes, helps keeps us up in front of everybody, keeps the show going. So bear with me because we haven't done this in a while.
No.
And I forgot where we left off. And me and Kyle, Kyle's got me a list, and I think it's further down than that. So I'm going to start off here with the people that have written us some. All right, folks. Ashton Schumann, YR Face, G103S, JWSFTP, Instaglado 83, Honeywell Badger, The 434 VZ, God Ravage, Sonoma Moviegoer, Twisted Mitch, Patrick McGriff, Send the Sharkney, Berklinstein, Anastasia Sims, Go ATFGHG, Johnny Friend,
thank you. Thank
Tennis Dog 2144, Miss Stacy Schmidt,
thank you.
Sly Snide 24, Wall Purgus Matt,
thank you.
Ever to Seer, Roger M007 AQ16, Striker ATL, Girl Getter.
Wow. Thank you.
Brick Brie, Recipe for Protein Shakes, SR Linton, History Goes Bump. It's another podcast.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Coyote Man 5, Yeah Buddy 98, CD Reeves, Willow Cricken, Caesar Tillen, Leppy Khan, Neil Holla, Nancy Brancy, Rob D. Williams, Moonshooter 3, Fumbles the Great, RWTXRH, Race Bunny 35, T. Bentz, Zach Tyler Fugate, S. George Lee, S. George Lee again here. Let's see, Army 310 Troy,
thank
Kyle
you,
W.
You.
225, Isabel 841, Bellin, Raider 87, Ebel Dobbins, K. Sox, Markometic, let's see, Mailman 9915, Canastic, Backwoods Barbarian, X Hemp, Spitfire Jackal, J.M. White. That's here in the U.S.
Yeah, moving on to other
thank
countries.
Thank you all so much.
Yeah, right?
Go, Philly.
In Canada, B. Miller Poncho and Chris Waz. Thank you very much. In the U.K., Max, Brad, Boogaloo Shrimp, Guitar George 123, Rakan 75. In Germany, Wolf Padzus. By the way, in Germany, there's two reviews, quite lengthy, written about us, but I cannot read German, so I have no idea what they say. I know that they're good.
Thank y'all.
Thank you very much, my German friends. In Australia, James Mum, Boatpool the Third, a questionnaire, Roach the Toadstool Jumper, Jabbles 1973, and Captain Puppy Boat. Oh, Puppy Butt. My sorry. Captain Puppy Butt. Thank you. In New Zealand, Dave Homewood and Rod Steele 18. And there's numerous other countries. One of the problems with iTunes is you have to search country by country. And my friend, there's like over 120 different countries in the world, so I don't have time to do all of that. But we appreciate it. And I mean, we don't know how far we're back. If we left you out, we really do apologize. I'm so sorry about that. If you'd like to share a story with Expanded Perspectives, you can always email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Or, of course, you can call us 817-945-3828. And if you're not a member of Elite, go over there now to the website, expandedperspectives.com, and sign up. You're going to enjoy it, folks. You're only listening to half the shows if you're only listening to these free ones. And you get to hear more of me and Cam. Cam, you got anything planned for the week, bud?
We've got a state inspection coming up this week I've got to deal with, and I've got some training. It's a sad thing that we've all got to go through with all this wild gunplay, but I've got some active shooter training I have to go to this week.
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, I've got a bunch of wild stuff to get ready before I head down to the coast.
I'm going to be babysitting my father the whole week. My mother's taking a trip with some friends to Mexico.
Pop-Pop's going to be here.
I got to babysit Pop-Pop all week.
Frankenstein.
It's not as fun as it sounds. It can be quite cantankerous. But I know I'll make it through. We'll probably have a bonfire out at his house and just talk and stuff like that. I still enjoy getting to spend time with my father. For you Elite members, we'll speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, keep your nose to the grindstone. And for God's sakes, please stay out of trouble. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hill.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.